lashing out with his nightstick. He made a series of black marks on the wall, but missed the rat. Jeannie watched Robinson with a warning alarm ringing in her mind. There was something wrong here, something that did not make sense. This was a humorous jape. Dennis was not a practical joker. He was a sexual pervert and a murderer. What he had done was uncharacteristic. Unless, she realized with a tremor of dread, this was a diversion, and Dennis had some other purpose. She felt something touch her hair. She turned around in her chair, and her heart stopped. Dennis had moved and was standing up close to her. In front of her face, he held what looked like a homemade knife. It was a tin spoon with a bowl flattened and sharpened to a point. She wanted to scream, but she felt strangled. A second ago, she had thought herself perfectly safe. Now she was being threatened by a murderer with a knife. How could it have happened so quickly? The blood seemed to drain out of her head, and she could hardly think. Dennis grabbed her hair with his left hand and moved the point of the knife so close to her eye that she could not focus on it. He bent over and spoke in her ear. His breath was warm on her cheek, and he smelled sweaty. His voice was so low that she could hardly hear him over the noise Robinson was making. "Do as I say, or I'll slice your eyeballs." She melted with terror. "Oh, God, no. Don't make me blind," she pleaded. Hearing her own voice speak in such an alien tone of groveling surrender brought her to her senses somewhat. She tried desperately to pull herself together and think. Robinson was still chasing the rat. He had no idea what Dennis was up to. Jeannie could hardly believe this was happening. They were in the heart of a state prison, and she had an armed guard, yet she was at Dennis's mercy. How glibly she had thought, a few short hours ago, that she would give him a hard time if he attacked her. She began to tremble with fear. Dennis jerked painfully on her hair, pulling up, and she shot to her feet. "Please," she said. Even as she spoke, she hated herself for begging in this humiliating way, but she was too terrified to stop. "I'll do anything." She felt his lips on her ear. "Take off your panties," he murmured. She froze. She was ready to do whatever he wanted, no matter how shaming, in order to escape. But to take off her panties might be as dangerous as to defy him. She did not know what to do. She tried to see Robinson. He was out of her field of view, behind her, and she did not dare turn her head because of the knife next to her eye. However, she could hear him cursing the rat and swiping at it with his club, and it was evident he still had not seen what Dennis was doing. "I don't have much time," Dennis murmured in a voice like an icy wind. "If I don't get what I want, you'll never see the sun shine again." She believed him. She had just finished 3 hours of psychological interviews with him, and she knew what he was like. He had no conscience. He was not capable of guilt or remorse. If she frustrated his wishes, he would maim her without hesitation. But what would he do after she had taken off her panties? She thought desperately. Would he be satisfied and take the blade away from her face? Would he slash her anyway? Or would he want something more? Why couldn't Robinson kill the damned rat? "Quickly," Dennis hissed. What could be worse than blindness? "All right," she groaned. She bent awkwardly, with Dennis still holding her hair and pointing the knife at her. Fumbling, she pulled up the skirt of her linen dress and pushed down her Kmart white cotton briefs. Dennis grunted, deep in his throat like a bear, as they dropped to her ankles. She felt ashamed, even though reason told her this was not her fault. Hurriedly, she worked her dress back down, covering her nakedness. Then she stepped out of her panties and kicked them away across the gray plastic-tiled floor. She felt dreadfully vulnerable. Dennis released her, snatched up the panties and pressed them to his face, breathing in, his eyes closed in ecstasy. Jeannie stared at him, aghast at this forced intimacy. Even though he was not touching her, she shuddered in disgust. What would he do next? Robinson's nightstick made a revolting, squashing sound. Jeanie turned and saw that at last he had struck the rat. His stick had smashed the rear half of its fat body, and there was a red smear across the gray plastic tiles. It could no longer run, but it was still alive, its eyes open and its body moving as it breathed. Robinson hit it again, smashing its head. It stopped moving, and a gray slime seeped out of the crushed skull. Jeanie looked back at Dennis. To her surprise, he was sitting at the table, as he had all afternoon, looking as if he had never moved. He wore an innocent air. The knife and her panties had disappeared. Was she out of danger? Was it all over? Robinson was panting with exertion. He directed a suspicious glare at Dennis and said, "You didn't bring that vermin in here, Pinker, did you?" "No, sir," Dennis said glibly. Jeanie formed in her mind the words, "Yes, he did," but for some reason she did not say them. Robinson went on, "'Cause if I thought you'd done a thing like that, I would—" The guard shot a sideways look at Jeanie and decided not to say exactly what he would do to Dennis. "I believe you know I'd make you regret it." "Yes, sir." Jeanie realized she was safe, but relief was followed immediately by anger. She stared at Dennis, outraged. Was he going to pretend that nothing had happened? Robinson said, "Well, you can get a bucket of water and clean this place up anyway." "Right away, sir. That is, if Dr. Ferrami is finished with you." Jeanie tried to say, "While you were killing the rat, Dennis stole my panties." But the words would not come out. They seemed so foolish, and she could imagine the consequences of saying them. She would be stuck here for an hour while the allegation was investigated. Dennis would be searched and her underwear found. It would have to be shown to Warden Des Moines. She imagined him examining the evidence, handling her panties and turning them inside out, with a strange look on his face. No, she would say nothing. She suffered a pang of guilt. She had always scorned women who suffered assault and then kept quiet about it, letting the offender get away with it. Now she was doing the same thing. She realized that Dennis was counting on that. He had foreseen how she would feel and gambled that he could get away with it. The thought made her so indignant that for a moment she contemplated putting up with the hassle just to thwart him. Then she envisioned Des Moines and Robinson and all the other men in this jail looking at her and thinking, "She doesn't have any panties on." And she realized it would be too humiliating to be borne. How clever Dennis was, as clever as the man who had set fire to the gymnasium and raped Lisa, as clever as Steve. "You seem a little shook," Robinson said to her. "I guess you don't like rats any more than I do." She pulled herself together. It was over. She had survived with her life and even her eyesight. What happened that was so bad, she asked herself. I might have been mutilated or raped. Instead, I just lost my underwear. Be grateful. "I'm fine, thank you," she said. "In that case, I'll take you out." The three of them left the room together. Outside the door, Robinson said, "Go get a mop, Pinker." Dennis smiled at Jeanie, a long, intimate smile, as if they were lovers who had spent the afternoon in bed together. Then he disappeared into the interior of the jail. Jeanie watched him go with immense relief, but it was tinged with continuing revulsion, for he had her underwear in his pocket. Would he sleep with her panties pressed to his cheek, like a child with a teddy bear? Or would he wrap them around his penis as he masturbated, pretending that he was fucking her? Whatever he chose to do, she felt she was an unwilling participant, her privacy violated, and her freedom compromised. Robinson walked her to the main gate and shook her hand. She crossed the hot parking lot to the Ford, thinking, "I'll be glad to drive out of this place." She had a sample of Dennis's DNA. That was the most important thing. Lisa was at the wheel, running the air conditioning to cool the car. Jeanie slumped into the passenger seat. "You look beat," Lisa said as she pulled away. "Stop at the first shopping strip," Jeanie said. "Sure. What do you need?" I'll tell you, Jeanie replied, but you're not going to believe it. 19. After lunch, Barrington went to a quiet neighborhood bar and ordered a martini. Jim Proust's casual suggestion of murder had shaken him. Barrington knew he had made a fool of himself by grabbing Jim's lapel and yelling, but he did not regret the fuss. At least he could be sure Jim knew exactly how he felt. It was nothing new for them to fight. He remembered their first great crisis in the early 70s when the Watergate scandal broke. It had been a terrible time. Conservatism was discredited. The law and order politicians turned out to be crooked, and any clandestine activity, no matter how well-intentioned, was suddenly viewed as an unconstitutional conspiracy. Preston Bark had been terrified and wanted to give up the whole mission. Jim Proust had called him a coward, argued angrily that there was no danger, and proposed to carry it on as a joint CIA-Army project, perhaps with tighter security. No doubt he would have been ready to assassinate any investigative journalist who pried into what they were doing. It had been Barrington who suggested setting up a private company and distancing themselves from the government. Now, once again, it was up to him to find a way out of their difficulties. The place was gloomy and cool. A TV set over the bar showed a soap opera, but the sound was turned down. The cold gin calmed Barrington. His anger at Jim gradually evaporated, and he focused his mind on Jeanie Farami. Fear had caused him to make a rash promise. He had recklessly told Jim and Preston that he would deal with Jeanie. Now he had to fulfill that imprudent undertaking. He had to stop her asking questions about Steve Logan and Dennis Pinker. It was maddeningly difficult. Although he had hired her and arranged her grant, he could not simply give her orders. As he had told Jim, the university was not the army. She was employed by JFU, and Genetico had already handed over a year's funding. In the long term, of course, he could easily pull the plug on her. But that was not good enough. She had to be stopped immediately, today or tomorrow, before she learned enough to ruin them all. Calm down, he thought. Calm down. Her weak point was her use of medical databases without the permission of the patients. It was the kind of thing the newspapers could make into a scandal, regardless of whether anyone's privacy was genuinely invaded. And universities were terrified of scandal. It played havoc with their fundraising. It was tragic to wreck such a promising scientific project. It went against everything Barrington stood for. He had encouraged Jeanie, and now he had to undermine her. She would be heartbroken, and with reason. He told himself that she had bad genes and would have got into trouble sooner or later. But all the same, he wished he did not have to be the cause of her downfall. He tried not to think about her body. Women had always been his weakness. No other vice tempted him. He drank in moderation, never gambled, and could not understand why people took drugs. He had loved his wife, Vivi, but even then he had not been able to resist the temptation of other women, and Vivi had eventually left him because of his fooling around. Now when he thought of Jeanie, he imagined her running her fingers through his hair and saying, "You've been so good to me. I owe you so much. How can I ever thank you?" Such thoughts made him feel ashamed. He was supposed to be her patron and mentor, not her seducer. As well as desire, he felt burning resentment. She was just a girl, for God's sake. How could she be such a threat? How could a kid with a ring in her nose possibly jeopardize him and Preston and Jim when they were on the brink of achieving their lifetime ambitions? It was unthinkable they should be thwarted now. The idea made him dizzy with panic. When he was not imagining himself making love to Jeanie, he had fantasies of strangling her. All the same, he was reluctant to start a public outcry against her. It was hard to control the press. There was a chance they would begin by investigating Jeanie and finish up investigating him. This would be a dangerous strategy. But he could think of no other, short of Jim's wild talk of murder. He drained his glass. The bartender offered him another martini, but he declined. He looked around the bar and spotted a payphone next to the men's room. He swiped his American Express card through the card reader and called Jim's office. One of Jim's brash young men answered. Senator Proust's office. This is Barrington Jones. I'm afraid the senator is in a meeting right now. He really should train his acolytes to be a little more charming, Barrington thought. Then let's see if we can avoid interrupting him, he said. Does he have any media appointments this afternoon?
I'm not sure. May I ask why you need to know, sir?
No, young man, you may not, Barrington said with exasperation. Self-important assistants were the curse of Capitol Hill. You may answer my question, or you may put Jim Proust on the phone, or you may lose your goddamn job. Now, which is it to be?
Please hold.
There was a long pause. Barrington reflected that wishing Jim would teach his aides to be charming was like hoping a chimpanzee would teach its young table manners. The boss's style spread to the staff. An ill-mannered person always had rude employees. A new voice came on the phone. Professor Jones, in 15 minutes the senator is due to attend a press conference to launch Congressman Dinkie's book, New Hope for America. That was just perfect.
Where?
The Watergate Hotel. Tell Jim I'll be there, and make sure my name is on the guest list, please. Barrington hung up without waiting for a reply. He left the bar and got a cab to the hotel. This would need to be handled delicately. Manipulating the media was hazardous. A good reporter might look past the obvious story and start asking why it was being planted. But each time he thought of the risks, he reminded himself of the rewards and steeled his nerve. He found the room where the press conference was to be held. His name was not on the list. Self-important assistants were never efficient, but the book's publicist recognized his face and welcomed him as an additional attraction for the cameras. He was glad he had worn the striped Turnbull and Asser shirt that looked so distinguished in photographs. He took a glass of Perrier and looked around the room. There was a small lectern in front of a blow-up of the book's cover and a pile of press releases on a side table. The TV crews were setting up their lights. Barrington saw one or two reporters he knew, but none he really trusted. However, more were arriving all the time. He moved around the room, making small talk, keeping an eye on the door. Most of the journalists knew him. He was a minor celebrity. He had not read the book, but Dinkie subscribed to a traditionalist right-wing agenda that was a mild version of what Barrington shared with Jim and Preston, so Barrington was happy to tell reporters that he endorsed the book's message. At a few minutes past 3, Jim arrived with Dinkie. Close behind them was Hank Stone, a senior New York Times man, bald, red-nosed, bulging over the waistband of his pants, shirt collar undone, tie pulled down, tan shoes scuffed. He had to be the worst-looking man in the White House press corps. Barrington wondered if Hank would do. Hank had no known political beliefs. Barrington had met him when he did an article about Genetico 15 or 20 years ago. Since getting the Washington job, he had written about Barrington's ideas once or twice, and Jim Proust's several times. He treated them sensationally rather than intellectually, as newspapers inevitably did, but he never moralized in the pious way liberal journalists would. Hank would treat a tip-off on its merits. If he thought it was a good story, he would write it. But could he be trusted not to dig deeper? Barrington was not sure. He greeted Jim and shook hands with Dinkie. They talked for a few minutes while Barrington looked out hopefully for a better prospect. But none came, and the press conference started. Barrington sat through the speeches, containing his impatience. There was just not enough time. Given a few days, he could find someone better than Hank. But he did not have a few days. He had a few hours. And an apparently fortuitous meeting like this was so much less suspicious than making an appointment and taking the journalist to lunch. When the speeches were over, there was still no one better than Hank in view. As the journalists dispersed, Barrington buttonholed him. Hank, I'm glad I ran into you. I may have a story for you.
Good.
It's about misuse of medical information on databases. He made a face.
Not really my kind of thing, Barry, but go on.
Barrington groaned inwardly. Hank did not seem to be in a receptive mood. He plowed on, working his charm, I believe it is your kind of thing, because you'll see potential in it that an ordinary reporter might overlook.
Well, try me.
First of all, we're not having this conversation.
That's a little more promising.
Second, you may wonder why I'm giving you the story, but you're never going to ask.
Better and better, Hank said,
but he did not make a promise. Barrington decided not to push him on it. At Jones Falls University, in the psychology department, there's a young researcher called Dr. Jean Ferrami. In her search for suitable subjects to study, she scans large medical databases without the permission of the people whose records are on the files. Hank pulled at his red nose.
Is this a story about computers or about scientific ethics?
I don't know.
You're the journalist.
He looked unenthusiastic.
It isn't much of a scoop.
Don't start playing hard to get, you bastard. Barrington touched Hank's arm in a friendly gesture. Do me a favor. Make some inquiries, he said persuasively. Call the university president.
His name is Maurice O'Bell.
Call Dr. Ferrani. Tell them it's a big story and see what they say. I believe you'll get some interesting reactions.
I don't know. I promise you, Hank, it will be worth your time.
Say yes, you son of a bitch. Say yes. Hank hesitated, then said,
Okay, I'll give it a whirl.
Barrington tried to conceal his satisfaction behind an expression of gravity, but he could not help a little smile of triumph.
Hank saw it, and a suspicious frown crossed his face. You're not trying to use me, are you, Barry? Like to frighten someone, maybe?
Barrington smiled and put an arm around the reporter's shoulders.
Hank, he said, trust me.
20. Jeannie bought a three-pack of white cotton panties at a Walgreens in a strip mall just outside Richmond. She slipped a pair on in the ladies' restroom of the neighboring Burger King. Then she felt better. Strange how defenseless she had felt without underwear. She had hardly been able to think of anything else. Yet when she was in love with Will Temple, she had liked to go around with no panties on. It made her feel sexy all day. Sitting in the library or working in the lab or just walking down the street, she would fantasize that Will showed up unexpectedly, in a fever of passion, saying, There isn't much time, but I've got to have you, now, right here. And she was ready for him. But without a man in her life, she needed her underwear like she needed shoes. Properly dressed again, she returned to the car. Lisa drove them to the Richmond-Williamsburg airport, where they checked their rental car and caught the plane back to Baltimore. The key to the mystery must lie with the hospital where Dennis and Stephen were born, Jeannie mused as they took off. Somehow, identical twin brothers had ended up with different mothers. It was a fairy tale scenario, but something like it must have happened. She looked through the papers in her case and checked the birth information on the two subjects. Stephen's birthday was August 25th. To her horror, she found that Dennis's birthday was September 7th, almost 2 weeks later. There must be a mistake, she said. I don't know why I didn't check this before. She showed Lisa the conflicting documents. We can double-check, Lisa said. Do any of our forms ask which hospital the subject was born at? Lisa gave a rueful laugh. I believe that's one question we didn't include. It must have been a military hospital in this case. Colonel Logan is in the army, and presumably the major was a soldier at the time Dennis was born. We'll check. Lisa did not share Jeannie's impatience. For her, it was just another research project. For Jeannie, it was everything. I'd like to call right away, she said. Is there a phone on this plane? Lisa frowned. Are you thinking of calling Stephen's mother? Jeannie heard the note of disapproval in Lisa's voice.
Yes. Why shouldn't I?
Does she know he's in jail? Good point. I don't know.
Damn. I shouldn't be the one to break the news.
He may have called home already.
Maybe I'll go see Stephen in jail. That's allowed, isn't it?
I guess so. But they might have visiting hours, like hospitals.
I'll just show up and hope for the best. Anyway, I can call the Pinkers.
She waved at a passing stewardess.
Is there a phone on the plane?
No, I'm sorry.
Too bad.
The stewardess smiled.
Don't you remember me, Jeannie?
Jeannie looked at her for the first time and recognized her immediately.
Penny Watermeadow, she said. Penny had done her doctorate in English at Minnesota alongside Jeannie.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm at Jones Falls, doing a research project that's running into problems.
I thought you were going after an academic job.
I was, but I didn't get one.
Jeannie felt embarrassed that she had been successful where her friend had failed.
That's too bad.
I'm glad now. I enjoy this work, and it pays better than most colleges.
Jeannie did not believe her. It shocked her to see a woman with a doctorate working as a stewardess.
I always thought you'd be such a good teacher. I taught high school for a while. I got knifed by a student who disagreed with me about Macbeth. I asked myself why I was doing it, risking my life to teach Shakespeare to kids who couldn't wait to go back out on the streets and get on with stealing money to buy crack cocaine.
Jeannie remembered the name of Penny's husband.
How's Danny?
He's doing great. He's area sales manager now. It means he has to travel a lot, but it's worth it.
Well, it's good to see you again. Are you based in Baltimore?
Washington, D.C.
Give me your phone number. I'll call you up.
Jeannie offered a ballpoint, and Penny wrote her phone number on one of Jeannie's file folders.
We'll have lunch, Penny said. It'll be fun.
You bet.
Penny moved on.
Lisa said, she seemed bright. She's very clever. I'm horrified. There's nothing wrong with being a stewardess, but it's kind of a waste of 25 years of education.
Are you going to call her?
Hell no. She's in denial. I'd just remind her of what she used to hope for. It would be agony.
I guess. I feel sorry for her.
So do I.
As soon as they landed, Jeannie went to a payphone and called the Pinkers in Richmond. But their line was busy.
Damn, she said querulously.
She waited 5 minutes, then tried again, but she got the same infuriating tone.
Charlotte must be calling her violent family to tell them all about our visit, she said.
I'll try later.
Lisa's car was in the parking lot. They drove into the city, and Lisa dropped Jeannie at her apartment. Before getting out of the car, Jeannie said,
Could I ask you a great big favor?
Sure. I'm not saying I'll do it, though.
Lisa grinned. Start the DNA extraction tonight.
Her face fell. Oh, Jeannie, we've been out all day. I have to shop for dinner.
I know, and I have to visit the jail.
Let's meet at the lab later, say at 9 o'clock.
Okay,
Lisa smiled.
I'm kind of curious to know how the test turns out.
If we start tonight, we could have a result by the day after tomorrow.
Lisa looked dubious. Cutting a few corners, yes.
Atta girl!
Jeannie got out of the car and Lisa drove away. Jeannie would have liked to get right into her car and drive to police headquarters, but she decided she should check on her father first. So she went into the house. He was watching Wheel of Fortune.
Hi, Jeannie. You're home late, he said.
I've been working, and I haven't finished yet, she said.
How was your day?
A little dull, here on my own.
She felt sorry for him. He seemed to have no friends. However, he looked a lot better than he had last night. He was clean and shaved and rested. He had warmed up a pizza from her freezer for his lunch. The dirty dishes were on the kitchen counter. She was about to ask him who the hell he thought was going to put them in the dishwasher, but she bit back her words. She put down her briefcase and began to tidy up. He did not turn off the TV.
I've been to Richmond, Virginia, she said.
That's nice, honey. What's for dinner?
No, she thought. This can't go on. He's not going to treat me like he treated Mom.
Why don't you make something, she said.
That got his attention. He turned from the TV to look at her.
I can't cook.
Nor can I, Daddy.
He frowned. Then smiled.
So we'll eat out.
The expression on his face was hauntingly familiar. Jeannie flashed back 20 years. She and Patty were wearing matching flared denim jeans. She saw Daddy with dark hair and sideburns saying, go to the carnival. Shall we get cotton candy? Jump in the car.
He had been the most wonderful man in the world. Then her memory jumped 10 years. She was in black jeans and Doc Martin boots, and Daddy's hair was shorter and graying, and he said, I'll drive you up to Boston with your stuff. I'll get a van. It'll give us a chance to spend time together. We'll eat fast food on the road. It'll be such fun. Be ready at 10. She had waited all day, but he never showed up, and the next day she took a greyhound. Now, seeing the same old let's-have-fun light in his eyes, she wished with all her heart that she could be 9 years old again and believe every word he said. But she was grown up now, so she said, How much money do you have? He looked sullen. I don't have any, I told you. Me either, so we can't eat out. She opened the refrigerator. She had an iceberg lettuce, some fresh corn on the cob, a lemon, a pack of lamb chops, one tomato, and a half-empty box of Uncle Ben's rice. She took them all out and put them on the counter. I tell you what, she said. We'll have fresh corn with melted butter as an appetizer, followed by lamb chops with lemon zest, accompanied by salad and rice, and ice cream for dessert. Well, that's just great. You get it started while I'm out. He stood up and looked at the food she had put out. She picked up her briefcase. I'll be back soon after 10. I don't know how to cook this stuff. He picked up a corn cob. From the shelf over the refrigerator, she took the Reader's Digest All the Year-Round Cookbook. She handed it to him. Look it up, she said. She kissed his cheek and went out. As she got into her car and headed downtown, she hoped she had not been too cruel. He was from an older generation. The rules had been different in his day. Still, she could not be his housekeeper, even if she had wanted to. She had to hold down her job. By giving him a place to lay his head at night, she was already doing more for him than he had done for her most of her life. All the same, she wished she had left him on a happier note. He was inadequate, but he was the only father she had. She put her car in a parking garage and walked through the red light district to police headquarters. There was a swanky lobby with marble benches and a mural depicting scenes from Baltimore history. She told the receptionist she was here to see Stephen Logan, who was in custody. She expected to have to argue about it, but after a few minutes' wait, a young woman in uniform took her inside and up in the elevator. She was shown into a room the size of a closet. It was featureless, except for a small window set into the wall at face level and a sound panel beneath it. The window looked into another similar booth. There was no way to pass anything from one room to the other without making a hole in the wall. She stared through the window. After another 5 minutes, Stephen was brought in. As he entered the booth, she saw that he was handcuffed and his feet were chained together, as if he were dangerous. He came to the glass and peered through. When he recognized her, he smiled broadly. This is a pleasant surprise, he said. In fact, it's the only nice thing that's happened to me all day. Despite his cheerful manner, he looked terrible, strained and tired. How are you? She said. A little rough. They've put me in a cell with a murderer who has a crack hangover. I'm afraid to go to sleep. Her heart went out to him. She reminded herself that he was supposed to be the man who raped Lisa, but she could not believe it. How long do you think you'll be here? I have a bail review before a judge tomorrow. Failing that, I may be locked up until the DNA test result comes through. Apparently, that takes 3 days. The mention of DNA reminded her of her purpose. I saw your twin today, and there's no doubt. He's your double. Maybe he raped Lisa Hoxton. Jeannie shook her head. If he had escaped from jail over the weekend, yes, but he's still locked up. Do you think he might have escaped, then returned, to establish an alibi? Too fanciful. If Dennis got out of jail, nothing would induce him to go back. I guess you're right, Stephen said gloomily. I have a couple of questions to ask you. Shoot. First, I need to double-check your birthday. August 25th. That was what Jeannie had written down. Maybe she had Dennis's date wrong.
And do you happen to know where you were born?
Yes. Dad was stationed at Fort Lee, Virginia at the time, and I was born in the Army hospital there.
Are you sure?
Certain. Mom wrote about it in her book, Having a Baby.
He narrowed his eyes in a look that was becoming familiar to her.
It meant he was figuring out her thinking. Where was Dennis born?
I don't know yet.
But we share a birthday.
Unfortunately, he gives his birthday as September 7th.
But it might be a mistake.
I'm going to double-check. I'll call his mother as soon as I get to my office.
Have you spoken to your parents yet?
No. Would you like me to call them?
No.
Please. I don't want them to know until I can tell them I've been cleared.
She frowned. From everything you've told me about them, they seem the kind of people who would be supportive.
They would, but I don't want to put them through the agony.
Sure, it would be painful for them, but they might prefer to know so they can help you.
No.
Please don't call them.
Jeannie shrugged. There was something he was not telling her.
But it was his decision.
Jeannie, what's he like?
Dennis?
Superficially, he's like you.
Does he have long hair, short hair, a mustache, dirty fingernails, acne, a limp?
His hair is short, just like yours. He has no facial hair. His hands are clean, and his skin is clear.
It could have been you.
Jeez. Stephen looked deeply uncomfortable.
The big difference is his behavior. He doesn't know how to relate to the rest of the human race.
It's very strange.
I don't find it so. In fact, it confirms my theory. You were both what I call wild children.
I stole the phrase from a French film. I use it for the type of child who is fearless, uncontrollable, hyperactive. Such children are very difficult to socialize.
Charlotte Pinker and her husband failed with Dennis. Your parents succeeded with you.
This did not reassure him.
But underneath, Dennis and I are the same.
You were both born wild.
But I have a thin veneer of civilization.
She could see he was profoundly troubled.
Why does it bother you so much?
I want to think of myself as a human being, not a house-trained gorilla.
She laughed, despite his solemn expression. Gorillas have to be socialized, too. So do all animals that live in groups. That's where crime comes from.
He looked interested.
From living in groups?
Sure. A crime is a breach of an important social rule. Solitary animals don't have rules. A bear will trash another bear's cave, steal its food, and kill its young. Wolves don't do those things. If they did, they couldn't live in packs. Wolves are monogamous. They take care of one another's young, and they respect each other's personal space. If an individual breaks the rules, they punish him. If he persists, they either expel him from the pack or kill him.
What about breaking unimportant social rules?
Like farting in an elevator? We call it bad manners. The only punishment is the disapproval of others.
Amazing how effective that is.
Why are you so interested in people who break the rules?
She thought of her father. She did not know whether she had his criminal genes or not.
It might have helped Steve to know that she, too, was troubled by her genetic inheritance. But she had lied about Daddy for so long that she could not easily bring herself to talk about him now.
It's a big problem, she said evasively. Everyone's interested in crime.
The door opened behind her, and the young woman police officer looked in.
Time's up, Dr. Ferrami.
Okay, she said over her shoulder.
Steve, did you know that Lisa Hoxton is my best friend in Baltimore?
No, I didn't.
We work together. She's a technician.
What's she like?
She's not the kind of person who would make a wild accusation.
He nodded. All the same, I want you to know that I don't believe you did it.
For a moment, she thought he was going to cry.
Thank you, he said gruffly.
I can't tell you how much it means to me.
Call me when you get out.
She told him her home number.
Can you remember that?
No problem.
Jeannie was reluctant to leave. She gave him what she hoped was an encouraging smile.
Good luck.
Thanks. I need it in here. She turned away and left. The policewoman walked her to the lobby.
Night was falling as she returned to the parking garage. She got onto the Jones Falls Expressway and flicked on the headlights of the old Mercedes. Heading north, she drove too fast, eager to get to the university. She always drove too fast. She was a skillful but somewhat reckless driver, she knew, but she did not have the patience to go at 55. Lisa's white Honda Accord was already parked outside Nuthouse. Jeannie eased her car alongside it and went inside. Lisa was just turning on the lights in the lab. The cool box containing Dennis Pinker's blood sample stood on the bench. Jeannie's office was right across the corridor. She unlocked her door by passing her plastic card through the card reader and went in. Sitting at her desk, she called the Pinker house in Richmond. "At last," she said when she heard the ringing tone. Charlotte answered. "How is my son?" she said. "He's in good health," Jeannie replied. "He hardly seemed like a psychopath," she thought, "until he pulled a knife on me and stole my panties." She tried to think of something positive to say. "He was very cooperative. He always had beautiful manners," Charlotte said in the southern drawl she used for her most outrageous utterances. "Mrs. Pinker, may I double-check his birthday with you?" "He was born on the 7th of September, like it should be a national holiday." It was not the answer Jeannie had been hoping for. "And what hospital was he born in?" "We were at Fort Bragg in North Carolina at the time." Jeannie suppressed a disappointed curse. "The major was training conscripts for Vietnam," Charlotte said proudly. "The Army Medical Command has a big hospital in Bragg. That's where Dennis came into the world." Jeannie could not think of anything more to say. The mystery was as deep as ever. "Mrs. Pinker, I want to thank you again for your kind cooperation." "You're welcome." She returned to the lab and said to Lisa, "Apparently, Stephen and Dennis were born 13 days apart and in different states. I just don't understand it." Lisa opened a fresh box of test tubes. "Well, there's one incontrovertible test. If they have the same DNA, they're identical twins, no matter what anyone says about their birth." She took out two of the little glass tubes. They were a couple of inches long. Each had a lid at the top and a conical bottom. She opened a pack of labels, wrote Dennis Pinker on one and Stephen Logan on the other, then labeled the tubes and placed them in a rack. She broke the seal on Dennis's blood and put a single drop in one test tube. Then she took a vial of Stephen's blood out of the refrigerator and did the same. Using a precision-calibrated pipette, a pipe with a bulb at one end, she added a tiny measured quantity of chloroform to each test tube. Then she picked up a fresh pipette and added a similarly exact amount of phenol. She closed both test tubes and put them in the Whirl mixer to agitate them for a few seconds. The chloroform would dissolve the fats and the phenol would disrupt the proteins, but the long-coiled molecules of deoxyribonucleic acid would remain intact. Lisa put the tubes back in the rack. "That's all we can do for the next few hours," she said. The water-dissolved phenol would slowly separate from the chloroform. A meniscus would form in the tube at the boundary. The DNA would be in the watery part, which could be drawn off with a pipette for the next stage of the test, but that would have to wait for the morning. A phone rang somewhere. Jeannie frowned. It sounded as if it were coming from her office. She stepped across the corridor and picked it up. "Yes? Is this Dr. Ferrami?" Jeannie hated people who called and demanded to know your name without introducing themselves. It was like knocking on someone's front door and saying, "Who the hell are you?" She bit back a sarcastic response and said, "I'm Jeannie Ferrami. Who is this calling, please?" "Naomi Friedlander, New York Times." She sounded like a heavy smoker in her 50s. "I have some questions for you." "At this time of night?" "I work all hours. It seems you do, too. Why are you calling me?" "I'm researching an article about scientific ethics." "Oh." Jeannie thought immediately about Steve not knowing he might be adopted. It was an ethical problem, though not an insoluble one. But surely the Times did not know about it. "What's your interest?" "I believe you scan medical databases, looking for suitable subjects to study." Oh, okay. Jeannie relaxed. She had nothing to worry about on this score. Well, I've devised a search engine that scans computer data and finds matching pairs. My purpose is to find identical twins. It can be used on any kind of database. But you've gained access to medical records in order to use this program. It's important to define what you mean by access. I've been careful not to trespass on anyone's privacy. I never see anyone's medical details. The program doesn't print the records. What does it print? The names of the two individuals and their addresses and phone numbers. But it prints the names in pairs. Of course, that's the point. So if you used it on, say, a database of electroencephalograms, it would tell you that John Doe's brainwaves are the same as Jim Fitz's. The same or similar, but it would not tell me anything about either man's health. However, if you knew previously that John Doe was a paranoid schizophrenic, you could conclude that Jim Fitz was too. We would never know such a thing. You might know John Doe. How? He might be your janitor. Anything. Oh, come on. It's possible. Is that going to be your story? Maybe. Okay. It's theoretically possible. But the chance is so small that any reasonable person would discount it. That's arguable. The reporter seemed determined to see an outrage, regardless of the facts, Jeannie thought, and she began to worry. She had enough problems without getting the damn newspapers on her back. How real is all this? She said. Have you actually found anyone who feels their privacy has been violated? I'm interested in the potentiality. Jeannie was struck by a thought. Who told you to call me, anyway? Why do you ask? Same reason you've been asking me questions. I'd like to know the truth. I can't tell you. That's interesting, Jeannie said. I've talked to you at some length about my research and my methods. I have nothing to hide. But you can't say the same. You appear to be, well, ashamed, I guess. Are you ashamed of the way you found out about my project? I'm not ashamed of anything, the reporter snapped. Jeannie felt herself getting cross. Who did this woman think she was? Well, someone's ashamed. Otherwise, why won't you tell me who he is? Or she. I have to protect my sources. From what? Jeannie knew she should lay off. Nothing was to be gained by antagonizing the press. But the woman's attitude was insufferable. As I've explained, there's nothing wrong with my methods, and they don't threaten anyone's privacy. So why should your informant be so secretive? People have reasons. It looks as if your informant was malicious, doesn't it? Even as she said it, Jeannie was thinking, why should anyone want to do this to me? I can't comment on that. No comment, huh? She said sarcastically. I must remember that line. Dr. Ferrami, I'd like to thank you for your cooperation. Don't mention it, Jeannie said, and she hung up. She stared at the phone for a long moment. Now what the hell was that all about? She said. Wednesday, 21. Barrington Jones slept badly. He spent the night with Pippa Harpenden. Pippa was a secretary in the physics department, and a lot of professors had asked her out, including several married men, but Barrington was the only one she dated. He had dressed beautifully, taken her to an intimate restaurant, and ordered exquisite wine. He had basked in the envious glances of men his own age dining with their ugly old wives. He had brought her home and lit candles, and put on silk pajamas, and made love to her slowly, until she gasped with pleasure. But he woke up at 4 o'clock and thought of all the things that could go wrong with his plan. Hank Stone had been sucking down the publisher's cheap wine yesterday afternoon. He might just forget all about his conversation with Barrington. If he remembered it, the editors of the New York Times might still decide not to follow up the story. They might make some inquiries and realize there was nothing much wrong with what Jeannie was doing. Or they could simply move too slowly and start looking into it next week, when it would be too late. After he had been tossing and turning for a while, Pippa mumbled, "Are you all right, Barry?" He stroked her long blonde hair, and she made sleepily encouraging noises. Making love to a beautiful woman was normally consolation for any amount of trouble but he sensed it would not work now. He had too much on his mind. It would have been a relief to talk to Pippa about his problems. She was intelligent, and she would be understanding and sympathetic. But he could not reveal such secrets to anyone. After a while, he got up and went running. When he returned, she had gone, leaving a thank-you note wrapped in a sheer black nylon stocking. The housekeeper arrived a few minutes before 8 and made him an omelette. Marianne was a thin, nervous girl from the French Caribbean island of Martinique. She spoke little English and was terrified of being sent back home, which made her very biddable. She was pretty, and Barrington guessed if he told her to blow him, she would think it was part of her duties as a university employee. He did no such thing, of course. Sleeping with the help was not his style. He took a shower, shaved, and dressed for high authority in a charcoal gray suit with a faint pinstripe, a white shirt, and a black tie with small red dots. He wore monogrammed gold cufflinks. He folded a white linen handkerchief into his breast pocket, and he buffed the toe caps of his black Oxfords until they gleamed. He drove to the campus, went to his office, and turned on his computer. Like most superstar academics, he did very little teaching. Here at Jones Falls, he gave one lecture per year. His role was to direct and supervise the research of the scientists in the department, and to add the prestige of his name to the papers they wrote. But this morning he could not concentrate on anything, so he looked out of the window and watched four youngsters play an energetic game of doubles on the tennis court, while he waited for the phone to ring. He did not have to wait long. At 9:30, the president of Jones Falls University, Maurice O'Bell, called. "We've got a problem," he said. Barrington tensed. "What's up, Maurice?" "Bitch on the New York Times just called me. She says someone in your department is invading people's privacy." "A Dr. Ferrami." "Thank God," Barrington thought jubilantly. "Hank Stone came through." He made his voice solemn. "I was afraid of something like this," he said. "I'll be right over." He hung up and sat for a moment, thinking. It was too soon to celebrate victory. He had only begun the process. Now he had to get both Maurice and Jeannie to behave just the way he wanted. Maurice sounded worried. That was a good start. Barrington had to make sure he stayed worried. He needed Maurice to feel it would be a catastrophe if Jeannie did not stop using her database search program immediately. Once Maurice had decided on firm action, Barrington had to make sure he stuck to his resolve. Most of all, he had to prevent any kind of compromise. Jeannie was not much of a compromiser by nature, he knew, but with her whole future at stake, she would probably try anything. He would have to fuel her outrage and keep her combative. And he must do all that while trying to appear well-intentioned. If it became obvious that he was trying to undermine Jeannie, Maurice might smell a rat. Barrington had to seem to defend her. He left Nuthouse and walked across campus, past the Barrymore Theater and the Faculty of Arts, to Hillside Hall. Once the country mansion of the original benefactor of the university, it was now the administration building. The university president's office was the magnificent drawing room of the old house. Barrington nodded pleasantly to Dr. O'Bell's secretary and said, "He's expecting me." "Go right in, please, Professor," she said. Maurice was sitting in the bay window overlooking the lawn. A short, barrel-chested man, he had returned from Vietnam in a wheelchair, paralyzed from the waist down. Barrington found him easy to relate to, perhaps because they had a background of military service in common. They also shared a passion for the music of Mahler. Maurice often wore a harassed air. To keep JFU going, he had to raise $10 million a year from private and corporate benefactors, and consequently, he dreaded bad publicity. He spun his chair around and rolled to his desk. "They're working on a big article on scientific ethics," she said. "Barry, I can't have Jones Falls heading that article with an example of unethical science. Half our big donors would have a cow. We've got to do something about this." "Who is she?" Maurice consulted a scratch pad. "Naomi Freelander. She's the ethics editor." "Did you know newspapers had ethics editors?" "I didn't. I'm not surprised the New York Times has one. End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette. Side 5. The Third Twin by Ken Follett. Continuing on page 163.
It doesn't stop them acting like the goddamn Gestapo. They're about to go to press with this article, they say. But yesterday, they got a tip-off about your Ferrami woman. I wonder where the tip came from, Barrington said. There are some disloyal bastards around. I guess so. Maurice sighed. Say it's not true, Barry. Tell me she doesn't invade people's privacy. Barrington crossed his legs, trying to appear relaxed when he was in fact wired taut. This was where he had to walk a tightrope. I don't believe she does anything wrong, he said. She scans medical databases and finds people who don't know they're twins. It's very clever, as a matter of fact. Is she looking at people's medical records without their permission? Barrington pretended to be reluctant. Well, sort of. Then she'll have to stop. The trouble is, she really needs this information for her research project. Maybe we can offer her some compensation. Barrington had not thought of bribing her. He doubted it would work, but there was no harm in trying. Good idea. Does she have tenure? She started here this semester as an assistant professor. She's 6 years away from tenure, at least. But we could give her a raise. I know she needs the money. She told me. How much does she make now? $30,000 a year. What do you think we should offer her? It would have to be substantial. Another $8,000 or $10,000. And the funding for that? Barrington smiled. I believe I could persuade Genetico. Then that's what we'll do. Call her now, Barry. If she's on campus, get her in here right away. We'll settle this thing before the ethics police call again. Barrington picked up Maurice's phone and called Jeannie's office. It was answered right away. Jeannie Ferrami? This is Barrington. Good morning. Her tone was wary. Had she sensed his desire to seduce her on Monday night? Maybe she wondered if he was planning to try again. Or perhaps she had already got wind of the New York Times problem. Can I see you right away? In your office? I'm in Dr. O'Bell's office at Hillside Hall. She gave an exasperated sigh. Is this about a woman called Naomi Freelander? Yes. It's all horseshit. You know that. I do, but we have to deal with it. I'll be right over. Barrington hung up. She'll be here momentarily, he told Maurice. It sounds as if she's already heard from the Times. The next few minutes would be crucial. If Jeannie defended herself well, Maurice might change his strategy. Barrington had to keep Maurice firm without seeming hostile to Jeannie. She was a hot-tempered, assertive girl, not the type to be conciliatory, especially when she thought she was in the right. She would probably make an enemy of Maurice without any help from Barrington. But just in case she was uncharacteristically sweet and persuasive, he needed a fallback plan. Struck by inspiration, he said, "We might rough out a press statement while we're waiting." "That's a good idea." Barrington pulled over a pad and began scribbling. He needed something that Jeannie could not possibly agree to, something that would injure her pride and make her mad. He wrote that Jones Falls University admitted mistakes had been made. The university apologized to those whose privacy had been invaded, and it promised that the program had been discontinued as of today. He handed his work to Maurice's secretary and asked her to put it through her word processor right away. Jeannie arrived, fizzing with indignation. She was wearing a baggy emerald green T-shirt, tight black jeans, and the kind of footwear that used to be called engineer boots, but were now a fashion statement. She had a silver ring in her pierced nostril, and her thick dark hair was tied back. She looked kind of cute, to Barrington, but her outfit would not impress the university president. To him, she would appear the kind of irresponsible junior academic who might get JFU into trouble. Maurice invited her to sit down and told her about the call from the newspaper. His manner was stiff. He was comfortable with mature men, Barrington thought. Young women in tight jeans were aliens to him. The same woman called me, Jeannie said with irritation. This is ludicrous. But you do access medical databases, Maurice said. I don't look at the databases. The computer does. No human being sees anyone's medical records. My program produces a list of names and addresses, grouped in pairs. Even that. We do nothing further without first asking permission of the potential subject. We don't even tell them they're twins until after they've agreed to be part of our study. So whose privacy is invaded? Barrington pretended to back her. I told you, Maurice, he said. The Times has it all wrong. They don't see it that way, and I have to think of the university's reputation. Jeannie said, Believe me, my work is going to enhance that reputation. She leaned forward, and Barrington heard in her voice the passion for new knowledge that drove all good scientists. This is a project of critical importance. I'm the only person who has figured out how to study the genetics of criminality. When we publish the results, it will be a sensation. She's right, Barrington put in. It was true. Her study would have been fascinating. It was heartbreaking to destroy it. But he had no choice. Maurice shook his head. It's my job to protect the university from scandal. Jeannie said recklessly, It's also your job to defend academic freedom. That was the wrong tack for her to take. Once upon a time, no doubt, university presidents had fought for the right to the unfettered pursuit of knowledge. But those days were over. Now they were fundraisers, pure and simple. She would only offend Maurice by mentioning academic freedom. Maurice bristled. I don't need a lecture on my presidential duties from you, young lady, he said stiffly. Jeannie did not take the hint, to Barrington's delight. Don't you? She said to Maurice, warming to her theme. Here's a direct conflict. On the one hand is a newspaper apparently bent on a misguided story, and on the other, a scientist after the truth. If a university president is going to buckle under that kind of pressure, what hope is there? Barrington was exultant. She looked wonderful, cheeks flushed and eyes flashing, but she was digging her own grave. Maurice was antagonized by every word. Then Jeannie seemed to realize what she was doing, for she suddenly changed tack. On the other hand, none of us wants bad publicity for the university, she said in a milder voice. I quite understand your concern, Dr. O'Bell. Maurice softened immediately, much to Barrington's chagrin. I realize this puts you in a difficult position, he said. The university is prepared to offer you compensation in the form of a raise of $10,000 a year. Jeannie looked startled. Barrington said, That ought to enable you to get your mother out of that place you're so worried about. Jeannie hesitated only for a moment. I'd be deeply grateful for that, she said. But it wouldn't solve the problem. I still have to have criminal twins for my research. Otherwise, there's nothing to study. Barrington had not thought she could be bribed. Maurice said, Surely there must be another way to find suitable subjects for you to study. No, there's not. I need identical twins, raised apart, at least one of whom is a criminal. That's a tall order. My computer program locates people who don't even know they're twins. There's no other method of doing that. I hadn't realized, Maurice said. The tone was becoming perilously amicable. Then Maurice's secretary came in and handed him a sheet of paper. It was the press release Barrington had drafted. Maurice showed it to Jeannie, saying, We need to be able to issue something like this today, if we're going to kill this story off. She read it quickly, and her anger returned. But this is bullshit! She stormed. No mistakes have been made. No one's privacy has been invaded. No one has even complained. Barrington concealed his satisfaction. It was paradoxical that she was so fiery, yet she had the patience and perseverance to do lengthy and tedious scientific research. He had seen her working with her subjects. They never seemed to irritate or tire her, even when they messed up the tests. With them, she found bad behavior as interesting as good. She just wrote down what they said and thanked them sincerely at the end. Yet outside the lab, she would go off like a firecracker at the least provocation. He played the role of concerned peacemaker. But, Jeannie, Dr. O'Bell feels we have to put out a firm statement. "You can't say the use of my computer program has been discontinued," she said. "That would be tantamount to canceling my entire project." Maurice's face hardened. "I can't have the New York Times publishing an article that says Jones Falls scientists invade people's privacy," he said. "It would cost us millions in lost donations." "Find a middle way," Jeannie pleaded. "Say you're looking into the problem. Set up a committee. We'll develop further privacy safeguards if necessary." Oh, no, Barrington thought. That was dangerously sensible. "We have an ethics committee, of course," he said, playing for time. "It's a subcommittee of the Senate." The Senate was the university's ruling council and consisted of all the tenured professors, but the work was done by committees. "You could announce that you're handing over the problem to them." "No good," Maurice said abruptly. "Everyone will know that's a stall." Jeannie protested. "Don't you see that by insisting on immediate action, you're practically ruling out any thoughtful discussion?" This would be a good time to bring the meeting to a close, Barrington decided. The two were at loggerheads, both entrenched in their positions. He should finish it before they started to think about compromise again. "A good point, Jeannie," Barrington said. "Let me make a proposal here, if you permit, Maurice." "Sure, let's hear it." "We have two separate problems. One is to find a way to progress Jeannie's research without bringing a scandal down upon the university. That's something Jeannie and I have to resolve, and we should discuss it at length later. The second question is how the department and the university present this to the world. That's a matter for you and me to talk about, Maurice." Maurice looked relieved. "Very sensible," he said. Barrington said, "Thank you for joining us at short notice, Jeannie." She realized she was being dismissed. She got up with a puzzled frown. She knew she had been outmaneuvered, but she could not figure out how. "You'll call me?" she said to Barrington. "Of course." "All right." She hesitated, then went out. "Difficult woman," Maurice said. Barrington leaned forward, clasping his hands together and looked down in an attitude of humility. "I feel at fault here, Maurice." Maurice shook his head, but Barrington went on. "I hired Jeannie Ferrami. Of course, I had no idea that she would devise this method of work. But all the same, it's my responsibility, and I think I have to get you out of it." "What do you propose?" "I can't ask you not to release that press statement. I don't have the right. You can't put one research project above the welfare of the entire university. I realize that." He looked up. Maurice hesitated. For a split second, Barrington wondered fearfully if he suspected he was being maneuvered into a corner. But if the thought crossed his mind, it did not linger. "I appreciate your saying that, Barry. But what will you do about Jeannie?" Barrington relaxed. It seemed he had done it. "I guess she's my problem," he said. "Leave her to me." 22. Steve dropped off to sleep in the early hours of Wednesday morning. The jail was quiet, Porky was snoring, and Steve had not slept for 42 hours. He tried to stay awake, rehearsing his bail application speech to the judge for tomorrow, but he kept slipping into a waking dream in which the judge smiled benignly on him and said, "Bail is granted. Let this man go free." And he walked out of the court into the sunny street. Sitting on the floor of the cell in his usual position, with his back to the wall, he caught himself nodding off and jerked awake several times. But finally nature conquered willpower. He was in a profound sleep when he was shocked awake by a painful blow to his ribs. He gasped and opened his eyes. Porky had kicked him and was now bending over him, eyes wide with craziness, screaming, "You stole my dope, motherfucker! Where'd you stash it? Where? Give it up right now or you're a dead man!" Steve reacted without thinking. He came up off the floor like a spring uncoiling, his right arm outstretched rigid, and poked two fingers into Porky's eyes. Porky yelled in pain and stepped backward. Steve followed, trying to push his fingers right through Porky's brain to the back of his head. Somewhere in the distance, he could hear a voice that sounded a lot like his own, screaming abuse. Porky took another step back and sat down hard on the toilet, covering his eyes with his hands. Steve put both hands behind Porky's neck, pulled his head forward, and kneed him in the face. Blood spurted from Porky's mouth. Steve grabbed him by the shirt, yanked him off the toilet seat, and dropped him on the floor. He was about to kick him when sanity began to return. He hesitated, staring down at Porky bleeding on the floor, and the red mist of rage cleared. "Oh, no," he said. "What have I done?" The gate of the cell flew open, and two cops burst in, brandishing nightsticks. Steve held up his hands in front of him. "Just calm down," said one of the cops. "I'm calm now," Steve said. The cops handcuffed him and took him out of the cell. One punched him in the stomach hard. He doubled over, gasping. "That's just in case you were thinking of starting any more trouble," the cop said. He heard the sound of the cell door crashing shut and the voice of Spike the turnkey in his habitual humorous mood. "You need medical attention, Porky?" Spike said. "'Cause there's a veterinarian on East Baltimore Street." He cackled at his own joke. Steve straightened up, recovering from the punch. It still hurt, but he could breathe. He looked through the bars at Porky. He was sitting upright, rubbing his eyes. Through bleeding lips, he replied to Spike, "Fuck you, asshole." Steve was relieved. Porky was not badly hurt. Spike said, "It was time to pull you out of there anyway, college boy. These gentlemen have come to take you to court." He consulted a sheet of paper. "Let's see, who else is for the Northern District Court?" "Mr. Robert Sandilands, known as Sniff." He got three other men out of cells and chained them all together with Steve. Then the two cops took them to the parking garage and put them on a bus. Steve hoped he would never have to go back to that place. It was still dark outside. Steve guessed it must be around 6 a.m. Courts did not start work until 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, so he would have a long wait. They drove through the city for 15 or 20 minutes, then entered a garage door in a court building. They got off the bus and went down into the basement. There were 8 barred pens around a central open area. Each pen had a bench and a toilet, but they were larger than the cells at police headquarters, and all 4 prisoners were put in a pen that already had 6 men in it. Their chains were removed and dumped on a table in the middle of the room. There were several turnkeys, presided over by a tall black woman with a sergeant's uniform and a mean expression. Over the next hour, another 30 or more prisoners arrived. They were accommodated, 12 to a pen. There were shouts and whistles when a small group of women were brought in. They were put in a pen at the far end of the room. After that, nothing much happened for several hours. Breakfast was brought, but Steve once again refused food. He could not get used to the idea of eating in the